And today's last word in business takes us back in history. Christie's Auction House is planning to put a computer up for sale. It's an Apple I, an ancestor of all those Macintosh computers around today. Many years ago, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak built this computer in Jobs' family garage. They considered it a leap forward in the home computer industry of the 70s because it came with a pre-assembled motherboard. You didn't have to put it together yourself. The Apple I sold in 1976 for $666.66. Apparently they weren't superstitious. Now this relic may sell in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, and it comes in the shipping box, complete with the return address of that garage in California. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inske. Let's look more closely now at one of the provisions in a plan to cut the federal deficit. The plan came from the co-chairman of a bipartisan commission created by President Obama. It includes a plan to lower income tax rates, but actually bring in more money by eliminating tax deductions. The plan would, for example, reduce or get rid of the mortgage interest tax deduction that is claimed by many millions of Americans. Here's NPR's Tamara Keith.
When it comes to tax breaks, they don't get much bigger than the mortgage interest deduction.
That will save taxpayers $104 billion in 2011.
Bill Ahern is with the Tax Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based research group.
That is a big tax cut for the nation's mortgage payers.
Which makes it both an attractive target, because it's big, and one that may just be impossible to go after, because it's popular. Just ask homeowners.
That's a good way to decrease your taxes. I actually refinanced my home to get a tax deduction.
You know, it's a big chunk. It's maybe the difference between making itemized deducting worthwhile and not.
That's the whole purpose of home ownership. That's one of the reasons. It's one of our biggest tax shelters for most working Americans.
That was Claire Dulong, Jeff Cutler, and Brenda Emanuel Moore in Washington, D.C. yesterday. And how do they feel about the idea of eliminating or reducing the mortgage interest deduction?
That would be a real tragedy.
That's a terrible thing to do. Why would they want to do that?
To be clear, the Deficit Commission's chairs aren't just targeting the mortgage interest deduction. They're proposing a restructuring of the whole tax system, eliminating all kinds of tax breaks while reducing tax rates overall. The Tax Foundation's Ahern says some big changes need to be made, and the time is right.
The public policy goal of pushing as many people as possible into mortgages was a boneheaded idea. So, the mortgage interest deduction has lost its luster.
Ahern and a great many economists say the mortgage interest deduction distorts the market, favoring housing over other parts of the economy.
In the case of the mortgage interest deduction, it has been built up into an icon by the mortgage lenders, the realtors, and the home builders.
But that icon isn't going anywhere without a fight.
It's been in the tax code for almost 100 years. And it should stay there. Now is not the time to tamper with this.
Lucian Salvan is with the National Association of Realtors. He says in the past, anything that even smacked of tampering with the mortgage interest deduction was dead on arrival in Congress. And he fully expects it to stay that way.
If it's not dead on arrival, there would be a real flurry of lobbying by the real estate industry.
There are 18 members of the Deficit Commission, many of them current members of Congress. And Salvan says anything that goes into its final report has to get 14 votes, a high threshold.
Everyone should keep their powder dry. This was just a trial balloon to see if how people would react to some ideas that may or may not be in the final report.
The final report is due December 1st. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. NASA's Deep Impact probe has been snapping pictures of a celestial body that's small, curvy, and spewing a lot of gas. I'm talking about a comet called Hartley 2, and it's the gassy part that has my next guest over the moon. Michael Ahearn is the principal investigator of NASA's Epoxy mission and professor of astronomy at the University of Maryland. If you check out Hartley 2 for yourself, you can go to our website, sciencefriday.com, to see pictures taken from a few hundred miles from the comet's nucleus. Let me bring Michael Ahearn into the picture. He's principal investigator of this mission and a professor of astronomy at the University of Maryland, as I said before. So, Michael, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. I'm glad to be back with you.
Thank you. What's so gassy about this comet? What makes it so gassy? Why are you interested in that?
Well, we knew going in that it was very gassy, but we didn't know why. And that was one of the things we wanted to investigate. And how is this comet very different from Tempel 1? One key thing is that it has a much smaller nucleus than Comet Tempel 1, where we delivered our impactor 5 years ago. And despite being much smaller, it puts out much more gas per second than does Tempel 1. And one of the things that we discovered in the approach images coming in close is that there appears to be a significant variation in the amount of dry ice that is evaporating as the comet rotates, and it appears that it is the dry ice that may be driving the activity. We normally think of comets as being driven primarily by water ice.
Uh-huh. So this has a combination of water and dry ice.
Correct.
Unexpectedly high?
Well, higher than we have measured before is what I should say.
Yeah.
We don't have good numbers yet, but there does appear to be much more carbon dioxide relative to water than in the other few comets we've measured. It's very hard to measure from Earth.
And so it's a pretty small comet giving out a lot of gas, basically.
Right.
Yeah. How small is it?
It's about 2 kilometers, a little over 3/4 of a mile long, and maybe half a mile wide and thick.
And
it's a long, skinny thing.
And is that why it was chosen, because of all the gas being given off?
Well, largely it was because it was very small, and that coupled with that large amount of gas were the two dominant criteria. The first one, though, was that it was small and therefore different from Tempel 1.
And what do you hope to learn from this? You know the source, you say? You know where the gas is coming from? What does a mission to a comet like this really tell you in the long term?
What we really want to know is how we got here, how the planets formed 4.5 billion years ago. And the comets preserve a much better record of those conditions than the planets do.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to use them to study how the planets formed. The problem is comets are influenced by their evolution every time they come very close to the sun. And what we're trying to do is separate out the parts of the comet that are due to evolution from those that have been there since 4.5 billion years ago. And looking at comets of very different sizes changes the importance of different processes relative to the primordial characteristics.
So these comets really are left over from the time the Earth formed, our solar system formed. That's
correct. Everything formed together 4.5 billion years ago.
Wow. Well, 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to talk about the comets. 1-800-989-TALK. Also, you can tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Where did you find this comet? Where is it living?
Well, this is one of a large group of comets called Jupiter family comets. Their orbits take them out a little bit beyond the orbit of Jupiter and bring them in to somewhere in the inner solar system, from a little bit inside the Earth's orbit to some of them only come into the orbit of Mars.
Mm-hmm.
But Jupiter's gravity is what is dominating the perturbation, the changes in their orbit over time.
Mm-hmm. If you want to see this comet, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have some of the photos that were sent back from there. Are there any other plans to go to other comets? Why would you pick a comet over, let's say, an asteroid? Or basically, are they all the same sorts of things? Comets having more dust and water and CO2, and asteroids being more hunky pieces of metal?
There's probably a continuum from asteroids that are really chunks of metal and hard rock through asteroids that are damp or wet and on out to comets. The comets are more interesting because the comets really are the cores of the giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They all have large cores, much bigger than the Earth, which basically are made up of comets. The asteroids have been somewhat mixed up, and in fact, recent theoretical calculations say they've been mixed up a lot, much to my own surprise. But because the outer parts of the solar nebula were very cold, figuring out what the conditions were, what gases would condense into ice, is a key question in understanding how the disk that the planets formed from was made and how materials moved from place to place.
Is it still thought that the water from all these untold number of comets hitting the Earth in its early life was the source of the oceans and the moisture on Earth?
Yeah, the source of the Earth's water, and of its organics for that matter, is still controversial. A large part of the community thinks that it did come from comets, or mostly come from comets. Another large segment of the community thinks it came from those very wet asteroids that were right next to the comets in the early formation scenario. And a smaller part of the community argues that the Earth collected the water and organics as it formed.
What camp are you in?
Well, I'm with the comet camp. I recognize there are problems with the model. We have too much heavy water compared to light water. Heavy water being what you need in nuclear reactors,
right.
Compared to what the Earth has. There's a little bit too much in the comets we've studied, but we haven't studied very many comets.
Let's go to Juan.
Expect differences.
Juan in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Juan. Are you there?
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Jeff, actually, from Michigan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have two questions about the comets. Number one, since they've been around for billions of years, why don't they just boil away in the vacuum of space? And number two, when they go around the sun, if they're so small and the ice is being melted and the rocks are being vaporized or whatever, why don't they just slowly get so small that they just disappear? Why do they stick around for millions of years?
Good. Yeah, if this comet is tiny now, how big could it have been originally?
Unfortunately, we can't calculate backwards to figure out how big it was originally, but we can certainly calculate forward, and indeed, it should disappear.
Yeah.
This probably loses a tenth of a percent of its radius every time it comes by the sun. So another 1,000 times by the sun, and it would all be gone. And that's characteristic of comets, depending on how close to the sun they comet when they're closest. They change the amount of material that they lose, but they all will lose material until they run out.
Does this have a big tail, this comet?
This does not have a particularly prominent tail. It has what you can easily see it in telescopic images, but it's not a dramatic one like some of the really bright comets that you see.
Will it get close enough to the Earth for us to see it and its tail?
Not anymore. Not now. It came closest to the Earth about the middle of October, and it is one of the comets that comes closest to the Earth. But because it's a very small comet, it was not an easy one to see. It was an easy object in binoculars for people who knew where to look. By now, it's moved to the southern hemisphere and is moving away from us.
Mm-hmm. One last question. Brian in Tipton, Michigan. Hi, Brian.
Wow. I'm glad you took my call because I got a really good question. I want to know, why does all of this stuff have to have an explanation of billions and trillions and gazillions of years ago? Why can't we just accept the fact? I mean, I know there's a lot of people that don't believe in God and believe in creation, but what if God created them? And there's really no explanation, and nobody's really ever going to know why we got so much water, why we got trees. Maybe nobody will ever know for sure.
Well, we may never know exactly how things came to pass, but God presumably created the universe to work in certain ways, and
right.
It's a little puzzling to understand why he would create it to work in ways that would deliberately mislead us about how it works. There are lots of natural processes that suggest that the entire solar system formed 4.5 billion years ago. Now, indeed, we may be misled, but there are so many different pieces of evidence that that seems very unlikely.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, Brian?
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. 1-800-998-8255. But you're asking these very simple questions. Where were the origins of the universe, the origins of our solar system, our galaxy? And there are these little clues left behind, right? Like these comets.
Right. We have these clues, and I don't think I've like to think that I have been deliberately misled.
Do you think it's in with our grasp to learn, to understand the origin? I mean, if we study it long enough.
It is. I certainly can believe that we will get to a point where we can no longer understand the physical processes. The classical theory of the universe, the Big Bang theory, mm-hmm. had a beginning, and that would have been the point at which God created the universe. But he could have created it in many ways, and the way in which he created it is up to us to find out.
Mm-hmm. So you don't have a conflict in your own mind about believing in God and believing in science at the same time?
No, I don't.
All right. That's a good way to end. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck. Good luck on your mission.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Michael Ahern is the principal investigator of NASA's Epoxy mission. They're gluing the comet back together. Professor of astronomy, at the University of Maryland. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
The late theater and film director Elia Kazan had a profound influence on America in the decades after World War II. One of those he touched was filmmaker Martin Scorsese, who says that Kazan inspired him to make movies. Scorsese has selected the Kazan films that are included in a new DVD set called the Elia Kazan Collection. In addition to familiar classics like On the Waterfront, the collection includes Scorsese's cinema essay, Letter to Elia, and 5 Kazan films never before available on DVD. Such significant titles as A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Viva Zapata, and America, America. Our critic at large, John Powers, says this is one collection that's as exciting for the films you don't know as for the ones you do.
It's one of life's teasing truisms that artists' landmark works aren't necessarily their best ones. A good example of this is Elia Kazan, one of the defining and polarizing figures in post-war American culture. Not only did Kazan help revolutionize the theater, he forever changed the movies, ushering in a whole new era of screen acting. He worked with the holy trinity of method dreamboats, Montgomery Clift, Marlon Brando, and James Dean, and he launched the likes of Warren Beatty, Lee Remick, and Eva Marie Saint. The trajectory of Kazan's career has now been charted in the Elia Kazan Collection, a box set featuring 15 of his key films. It's a terrific collection anchored by some of the most mythic performances in film history. Brando and Vivian Leigh in A Streetcar Named Desire, Brando again in On the Waterfront, he could have been a contender, and of course Dean in East of Eden, a groundbreaking performance so quirkily histrionic in its vulnerability that seen through today's wised-up eyes, Dean appears to be acting in a story by Kafka, not Steinbeck. These are films that everyone should see. But for me, the true pleasure of this set lies in other, lesser-known films that I actually like better. The finest is Wild River, a 1960 film set in the Tennessee Valley during the 30s. Clift plays Chuck Glover, a young federal administrator who's been sent to get an ornery old matriarch, that's Jo Van Fleet, to leave her plantation before it's flooded. He winds up getting romantically involved with her widowed granddaughter, who's played by Remick with such intense purity of emotion and such blueness of eye that she takes your breath away. Here, Glover tells the old lady that the TVA dams will give everyone electricity, but she's not buying it.
I expect that's what you call progress, isn't it?
And you don't.
No, sir, I don't. Taking away people's souls, putting electricity in place of them, ain't progress. Not the way I see it.
We're not taking away people's souls. Just the opposite. We're giving them a chance to have a soul. And it isn't just this dam. It's dam after dam after dam. We aim to tame this whole river.
You do? Well, I like things running wild, like nature meant. There's already enough dams locking things up, taming them, making them go against their natural wants and needs. I'm agin dams of any kind.
Kazan always had a fondness for cussed characters like that, no doubt because he was one himself. He was born of Anatolian Greek parents who emigrated to the U.S. when he was 4. It was a difficult life that made him a difficult man. In his great autobiography, A Life, he wrote that he woke up mad every single day. But his experience gave him an immigrant sense of America, its possibilities and its harsh realities. And this led him to big, juicy American stories, usually with serious social themes. Kazan tackled everything from anti-Semitism in Gentleman's Agreement to public health in Panic in the Streets, a terrific New Orleans noir starring Richard Widmark as a military doctor who's trying to run down a gang of crooks infected with plague. My favorite of these social pictures is A Face in the Crowd, a riveting, nasty 1957 movie about a demagogic TV star played with sinister brilliance by an Andy Griffith you'd never let around Opie. You can foresee today's media culture in every frame. Although Kazan could be a clunky director, he made great use of locations, boasted a gritty sense of reality, and guided actors into unfamiliar psychological depths. He was superb at exploring personal relationships, be it the love between father and daughter in A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, exquisitely acted by James Dunn and Peggy Ann Garner, or the immigrant ruthlessness of the hero in America, America. Based on his own uncle's story, this fiercely unsentimental movie follows a young man who does what it takes, and it takes cruel things, to make it from Anatolia to American soil. Bursting with chutzpah, Kazan himself did whatever it took to make it big in America, even as he enjoyed the fruits of success. He was a man who bragged about his sexual conquests. He joined in the Red Scare of the 50s, naming names in his testimony before the House Un-American Activities Committee. Although this tainted his own name in Hollywood to this day, it also made his subsequent movies far more interesting. Not coincidentally, his most powerful work is On the Waterfront, the story of an ex-boxer turned longshoreman, Brando's Terry Malloy, who informs on corrupt union bosses. In one of that film's most beautiful scenes, Terry and his girl, played by Eva Marie Saint, are up on a rooftop where he keeps pigeons. He tells it that the city is full of hawks. They hang around on the top of the big hotels, he says, and when they spot a pigeon in the park, they pounce. It's one measure of what made Kazan such a dominating figure that, more than half a century later, it's hard to be sure who he identified with more, the victimized pigeons or the predatory hawks.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed the Elia Kazan collection, now out on DVD. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley. Thank you.
Okay, we have news of a media merger this morning. It involves a familiar voice on this program. Tina Brown is editor-in-chief of the growing website, The Daily Beast, and she's with us once again. Tina, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
And we've learned that Tina's chunk of new media is merging its operations with one of the most venerable names in old media, Newsweek magazine, a staple of doctors' and dentists' offices for decades. And Tina, some people will hear that news and wonder, why do that?
Well, it's very exciting, Steve. This is going to be a 50-50 joint venture for the Newsweek Daily Beast company. The Daily Beast becomes the website, the digital operation of Newsweek, and Newsweek continues, of course, as a weekly magazine, and I shall be editing both. It's just exciting because it means that really both operations get to amplify their footprint. It means that the Daily Beast, terrific, young, vibrant team who've really, you know, created this front line of news and the adrenaline of a site, mm-hmm. can actually also now take that energy and have a different rhythm when they're producing magazine articles.
Although when you talk about magazines, the current owner is the businessman Sidney Harmon. He bought it from the Washington Post Company not too long ago, and it was reported, Tina, as you I'm sure know very well, he bought the magazine. He bought Newsweek magazine, it was said, for $1.
Correct.
Which suggests how the fortunes of magazines have really eroded over time.
They have indeed. I mean, they're in a parlous condition, a lot of them, but many of them are also surging back. I've never been someone who kissed off the world of print. I simply feel that it's a different medium and has to be treated as a different medium. The great thing, actually, about having spent 2 years in on the web and really taken my focus out of print is that I'm looking really back at print now with kind of the new eyes of an expatriate who has been away and now can sort of look back and see something with very different point of view. And really, one can see, having done so much web news now, I can actually see what a magazine can offer, which is unique in the marketplace, as a different kind of narrative rhythm. You know, in a magazine, you can be more reflective. You can be you can be more reconstructive. You can be predictive. You can offer a narrative that really tells you in at length and depth what just happened or what just really happened. And it plays in a kind of great syncopated rhythm, if you like, with the fast, furious, instant takes of the web. So it's a great sort of dual platform. We're going to offer our writers, photographers, artists of all kinds, as well as our marketers, really, a kind of double hit, which I think is very exciting. And I think it's also very exciting for the Newsweek staff.
Well, let's remind people that you, in the past, you edited Vanity Fair magazine. You edited the New Yorker magazine. You edited a magazine called Talk, which folded.
And Tatler magazine, which is my first magazine. This is my fifth magazine, actually. But I think of my career in publishing as four weddings and a funeral. You know, we had three magazines that worked, a website that worked, and one that didn't. So actually, I probably learned most from the one that didn't than the ones I did.
But if I imagined what's happened to magazines in recent years, I would say that the articles have become shorter and shorter and shorter and more like little web items, really. Are you saying that you want to, having grabbed a magazine now, you want to basically go back into longer form journalism? And do you think people will read it?
The mistake, I think, of many magazines is to think they can compete with the web. You just can't compete with the web. So it's a fantasy to imagine that you can sort of somehow figure out a way to kind of to beat the what I call the Daily Beast for that name for a reason, because it is media is a beast. I mean, it is a feral animal that you cannot possibly beat its fast and furious rhythms. But I think a magazine can offer something different. I mean, you know, you can go into length and depth on a subject that really comes at it from a wholly more marinated point of view, which I also think is very key in this culture, because we have a lot of information, but we don't have a lot of meaning. And a magazine can really bring meaning. And that I've always done with the magazines I've edited, Vanity Fair and New Yorker. You know, it's always been about not what happened, but what really happened. And that is what I think Newsweek can do.
I have to ask one irreverent or impertinent question, Tina Brown. Because the current owner of Newsweek paid $1, did you pay 50 cents to buy your share in?
Let's just say that we all came out of this very, very happy. You know what also makes me happy? That I'm the first woman editor of Newsweek, which is very exciting. You know that in the 1970s, the women editors of Newsweek launched a lawsuit against the management because there were hardly any women doing anything of any consequence on the magazine, and Women's Liberation took over, and they hired the great lawyer, Eleanor Holmes Norton, and they went to battle for their rights.
Wow.
I feel that a merger has created what a lawsuit couldn't.
Tina, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Tina Brown, editor-in-chief of The Daily Beast, and now we know also of Newsweek.